Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Rodney Robinson. Rodney's the co-founder and president of TabaPay. Rodney, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Hey, our pleasure. Super excited to have you on, especially given that right now, as we were talking before we got started here, you're in the heart of it all. You know, I don't think people necessarily appreciate the significance of Silicon Valley in tech until you really start to look at the numbers. In fact, I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and Cardiff's Peter Walker, who we've had on the podcast before, was just talking about some of the numbers, and something like 56% of all 2025 venture capital dollars were raised in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And yeah, that's actually up. I think it used to be a little over 40%. I think over the last couple of years, it's grown dramatically, which is great for California.
And then you start looking at, like, so just for point of reference, number two in the list, New York, $26 billion, as compared to Silicon Valley's $154 billion. Yeah. So with that, TabaPay, California, tech scene, let's start. What's the focus been with the company, and how long have you been at it?
So we've crossed our 9-year anniversary this year. Focus of the company, how can I put it? There's a movie called You've Got Mail. And they asked Tom Hanks, what do you do? And he says, we sell cheap books. Well, I'm going to start mine by saying we sell cheap payments. Mm. Going a little deeper in that, this is about regulated industries need easy, cheap, risk-free ways to move money. Whether a lender has to disperse and collect, a bank has to do account funding and transfer it out, or a money remitter has to take money from someone and put it in another country. All those companies are regulated. They need cheap, low risk, instant payments. Because in the end, when you're sending money, there's no invisible markup. When you're doing TVs, you can put a 20, 30% markup. Your consumer doesn't know what your profit is. When you're moving money, the consumer sees exactly how much you're charging. So they need low-cost payments to be able to have their markup lower too. So that's what we do. We do low-cost, instant payments, low risk for regulated industries, regulated companies.
Okay. Congrats on the anniversary. Fantastic. Look, if we can unpack the context, then so maybe the key is regulation, but, you know, why have transfers historically been more expensive and not less expensive?
Yeah, there's perceived risk in industry. When I started looking at this business, and actually I was in the business years ago, I ran a money transmitter and I tried to get card acquiring, right? I tried to be able to take Visa and MasterCard. It was almost impossible. I finally found a payment processor, this is 15, 20 years ago, that would let me take a Visa or a MasterCard in order to do an account funding transaction, put money in an account, then transfer it. I had to pay 3%. They perceived me as risky, right? And so they charged me more money, even though my margins were less. I was a safe, low margin business. So I looked at this and thought in the back of my mind, we need to solve this because I can't afford it. No one else can afford it. So it was an underserved industry. Regulated businesses were underserved, whether they were lenders, whether they were money transmitters or banks, they were underserved on card payments. Right. One more story. I had a company, I sold the MasterCard, and that company had distributors that served the lending space. And I would look at them charging lenders 2 or 3% to accept a debit card to pay debt, to pay a loan. And I said, my God, that is so much money a lender has to pay. So I put two and two together, right? Instant payments are important. They have to be low risk, low cost. And no one in the industry was doing that. And so we come along and this is what we do. Low risk, low cost, instant payments. Because I experienced it firsthand. I saw my partners were extracting this cream from the market. And I go, wow, this is underserved. So this is what we did. Okay.
So Capitalism at its finest, faster, better,
It
cheaper.
is. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what makes America great. You find something that's faster, better, cheaper, you can do it, then you win.
Fantastic. So, without revealing any trade secrets, what's been the key to your success to be able to lower costs?
So first is that you have to get rid of middlemen, right? You can imagine in a payment ecosystem, everyone that touches the payment makes some money. In your typical payment system, you have someone that sells to the merchant. Who's going to sell card acceptance to the merchant? They take a piece and they set the price. You have a processor that takes a piece. A bank takes a piece. Then you have the networks take a piece. So you squeeze everyone out. You squeeze the seller out, the processor out, and in some cases, the bank out, and you can deliver an experience where you control every aspect of the cost, and that lets you deliver it. And then when you deliver extreme volume, the networks love you. We do now 70 million, 75 million payments a month. This is right in close to $9 billion in payments a month. This is new business for the networks. If you look over the past 9 years, this is additional money that they are processing through the network they didn't have. This is non-trivial, right? My Visa, I work for Visa. Okay. I give Visa so much money and I thank them every day for the great network they run, that this is incremental business they have because of our services. So as part of it, they give us lower rates that we pass on to our merchants. So as you increase volume, increase importance to the networks, then you can deliver a truly lower cost payment to your merchant. And then invest a lot in the risk, right? Anytime you lose what's called a chargeback where someone disputes a payment, that costs you a huge amount of money. So if you can squeeze the price because your volumes are big, you deliver incremental business to the networks, you can eliminate the chargeback, the risk out of the business, and then do it instantly, you have a real game changer. And that's what we've done the past 9 years.
Okay, and how do you, again, it goes without saying, I don't want you to release reveal any trade secrets, but how do you minimize chargebacks?
There's no secret.
Okay.
It's easy. Okay. If you look in our business, which is debt repayment, letting cardholders pay for loans, dispersing loans, money remittances, it's all simple. The same card used over and over again. And if you look and study risk in our business, it's not traditional, sophisticated AI type fraud. It's simple, velocity-based fraud. Additionally, a lot of the banks, a lot of the issuers of the cards have tools you can use. So you combine what the network provides on the tooling with very simple velocity controls based on velocity on cards, velocity on devices, and you can squeeze risk out of this system. And then imagine we touch a third of American households every month. We have 100 million debit cards that we process. Okay. This is a huge business. And you can imagine with our merchant base, with our card base, we put these simple rules in place, the issue rules, and we have visibility to most US debit. And so if we see the same card used in different merchants across our vast base, we know exactly there's going to be fraud on a payment. So we deliver this cross merchant view of a card. Again, a third of American households use our system, not with our brand, but with our merchants' brands. We can deliver a very low risk proposition for our merchants.
So, said another way, I could think of velocity as a profile. You have an opinion of what a fraudulent and a non-fraudulent profile looks like, and you're able to run an algorithm to say what are the odds that this is legitimate or not.
Right. And if you see the same card or even the same person using multiple financial technology services, you know you're going to have a fraudulent event. And that's what we do. And we just have the tooling and the speed to be able to do it, 75 million times a month. And our peak, we go above 3.5 million transactions a day. This is a lot of volume. And most of it's debit cards because, again, money movement is debit card based, not credit card based.
Okay. And then from a product development perspective, you mentioned artificial intelligence. How have you been thinking about the technology in the offering?
So if you look at AI, what we're doing today is deploying it in, I'll call it analysis. Let us do a lot of data analysis quickly, okay, which gives us more insights into this cross-merchant fraud matrix. There are other uses of it, but that's in our online system. That's what we're doing.
Okay. And then you just triggered a thought. So it's a parallel, maybe a far parallel, but if you think of a concept like in a casino, the casinos know who their whales are.
Yes.
People who spend a lot of money. Are there similar concepts and understanding not only like who consistently makes payments, but represents a larger fee income?
We do. So actually, it almost works the reverse in that who haven't I seen before? That's the risky transaction. And you can, and our system lets you put patterns on people, patterns on cards. And we know this card's going to do large payments, right? They're paying installment loans or casinos, right? These people we haven't seen before. So we let the merchant decide when they want to take cards or not. And you can imagine we have a new customer at this merchant that wants to do a large transaction. We have visibility to that card likely at other merchants. And so we can give all those signals to the merchant.
And how does that evolve over time? Is there a score that helps them decide whether or not they're trending in the right direction?
Absolutely. That's what we do. We give them a score, and above or below a bar, they can accept the payment or not. They can pend it and not. But all this is required for this low risk, right? Low cost, instant payment. And you can imagine as money speeds up, we let merchants disperse money real time to bank accounts as well as collect it. As you speed payments up and you have fungible points on both ends, I have a card and I'm dispersing to a bank account, it increases the risk. Slow payments are less risky, instant payments are more risky. So it's part of the instant payment mantra that you have to deliver a risk solution with it as well.
Yeah, no, that makes really good sense. And it would be great to define what instant is. And before you do, if I'm going to throw it out there, I was just by chance, I was reading either earlier this week or last week, there was a criticism of the US payment industry vis-a-vis countries like India, who it's part and parcel to have instantaneous transfers. And I don't know enough to support the criticism of the US, but I would love your perspective of how the audience should think about instant.
So our country is fascinating because you can't dictate to anyone. Okay, so it's happened in India. India has NEFT and they've mandated it and it works. Brazil has Pix and it works. Britain has their faster payment system. It works. Those are government mandates. Can't do that in this country. And so it creates business opportunity and innovation, both. And so in this country, instant payments are fragmented to a point. You have ubiquity on the Visa, MasterCard networks where you can actually disperse money and collect instantly from any bank account using Visa, Master, Discover, right? So those companies have stepped in to avoid because the government can't dictate. Okay. You then have these, I'll call them nascent real-time rails at bank accounts that are delivered today. They cover about three quarters of US bank accounts, but they are not ubiquitous. Three quarters is a lot, and they're also push only. You can imagine Visa, MasterCard have these push and pull networks that are real time. The banks and the other Fed, they have these instant push networks. But regardless, the government can't dictate. Our country lets the best network win. And it's based on what the merchant needs or what the constituent needs, because there's room for everything. Where these other countries, hey, it's ubiquitous, everyone uses it, but it may be subpar in certain cases.
Yeah, I don't know that I never normally think of the government when I think of efficiency, so I'm gonna stick with
Right.
the US.
But
Makes sense.
let me just unpack that a little bit more, because I totally agree with you, by the way. If you look at Visa, right, Visa is a payment network, it's instant. But you could go, well, and they charge a lot of money, sure. But what do? They make you, the consumer, feel safe when you participate with a merchant, right? And so the Visa brand and MasterCard brands are much more than just a payment rail. They're this consumer warm blanket that created e-commerce. Without those brands, you'd never enter your darn card and have Amazon ship your product. You'd get screwed, or you'd think you would, right? But these government networks don't carry that. All they are payment rails. You need a whole brand on top of it to make the consumer feel safe they can do something. Okay. And that's why I think the private industry has a much better say in it than the government.
Only because I don't know. Is there but so there's no implicit guarantee from India or Brazil? No.
It's called irrevocable and buyer beware. Okay. And that's a little different in this country, right?
Yeah, I found myself having a conversation of the significance of high trust, in the last couple of years. I think, well, for a variety of reasons, but you bring up a great point. I think a lot of us take for granted just swiping either the debit or credit card, or especially if you're a merchant selling a product that you're gonna get compensated and that everything is gonna work the way it's intended.
Yeah. And so you asked a question about technology, AI, a little earlier. Let me digress a bit. As a company, what do you invest in? AI, crypto, stablecoin, quantum computing. But I will tell you, unpacking a bit, there's a lot of thought of stablecoins somehow replacing the payment networks. Okay. Is it something you could use to lower the cost of payments? And so if you look at stablecoin, if I want to pay you, I push money to you. It's an irrevocable payment. I have to trust you to do that, right? It may be lower cost, but I would argue Visa and MasterCard can make the cost practically zero if they wanted to. But their brands offer much more value than just pushing money to someone, right? And that was what we discussed previously. So it's more than technology to change a payment system. It's got to be much more than that.
No, I think that's really well said. This isn't just about speed. It's you have to appreciate that it's also about trust. And there's it sounds like at least today there's a trade-off.
There is, particularly in the non-face-to-face world, right? There's a ton of trust required for to make that efficient, and that's what the networks do today.
Makes good sense. You made reference to selling a company, I think it was to Visa earlier.
MasterCard. I sold the
MasterCard.
company to MasterCard.
If you can give us, the career trajectory leading up to Tabapay and what inspired you to subsequently start the company WorldLayers.
Yeah, so I've actually sold four companies in my life. My first one I sold for two Super Bowl tickets. One of my big mistakes in life. Okay, I should have held out.
Which Super Bowl game was this?
I went to the San Francisco 49ers Miami Dolphins in 1985 at Stanford. I think it was 85 at Stanford.
Okay. That would is that that's Joe Montana, and I presume the 49ers won.
Joe Montana, Dan Marino, and Joe Montana and the Niners won. Yes.
Yes.
I was there in person because I sold the company for those tickets. Okay.
Well, at least they won.
Yeah. But I've been in payments a long time. I was one of the folks in the early days of the internet working at IBM in Palo Alto, and we did internet banking and brokerage. I think we did the first internet bank with First Interstate Bank, and we did first bill payments. So I've been in payments a long time. I used to run a money transmitter and actually ended up buying that company. And then that was the genesis of instant payments, where we had instant payments to bank accounts. We created a company to do that, and MasterCard came and bought it. This was in 2013. And then all of our customers, and we had good customers actually back then, Stripe and Lyft were a customer, and we did a lot of payouts to Lyft for Stripe. Ticketmaster was a customer. But when we got into the regulated businesses, lending disbursements, money remittance disbursements, they wanted two-way payments. So MasterCard bought the company. It was a push payment business. They wanted our merchants wanted us to do both ways, instant push, instant pull. MasterCard didn't want to do that, so I left after 2 years. We started this company, and this makes instant payments again risk-free, easy, low cost, and that was been our mantra 9 years ago, and we still have that same theory today, just in the regulated industry.
Well, congratulations on the success. It'll be interesting how I got to know. How did you end up accepting two Super Bowl tickets as payment for selling a company?
So this was to Walgreens, okay? And so we had an inventory management system on a PC, which was unusual back in the 80s. And it was a school project, and we did it for Walgreens, and I sold them the software for two tickets. Anyway, I think that could have been a really big company. And then a company called Petrini's, I think, ended up buying it later, but I didn't make any money on it. Walgreens did.
Well, on that note, for all the founders and entrepreneurs in the audience, how have you thought about exits and selling your companies over the years?
Yeah, so I've never focused on the exit. I've always focused on building the company. This company in particular, I want to take public. And so I want my employees to win. And I've always felt like that. I want my employees to win. I want my customers to win. If you solve those two things, you'll win. Okay. Because never think about yourself, always think about your stakeholders. And that's what I try to do. Okay. Particularly customers.
And have you always been wired in that, or was there a lesson you learned one day where?
No, I've always felt like that. Every company, I wanted my stakeholders and customers to win. And I've actually done well on all the companies, but I've never solved for number one. Never have.
Ironic how it works itself out when you focus on creating value.
Yeah, actually, that's what it's all about. And that's what I would tell entrepreneurs, is just focus on creating value.
Why go public versus an acquisition?
I think it would help the employees more. We have 150 employees now. And I read a statistic that I think it was NVIDIA, 75% of those employees are millionaires. I think that is an amazing victory for the company. And I would love at the end of the day to have a similar statistic, right? I mean, it's not 10,000 people, but at 150 people, three quarters millionaires, I would think that's a high five moment for me.
Agreed 100%. And as a founder CEO myself, I have similar thoughts. It sounds like we're both conscious of our legacy. I guess I focus in on public in particular because I've had at least two people who've gone through the process tell me they wouldn't do it again. I totally appreciate making or helping staff and employees, change just the dynamic of their family trajectory, because now they have more material wealth. But on the same token, it's I don't know. Is it really, have you heard, is it as painful as it's supposed to be?
So if you look, it's about corporate governance and transparency, being a public company and have a predictable business. And as a payment company, we're licensed as well in the States. We have to have that. So I don't look at the public company as doing anything we aren't doing today, right? I have to have transparency and a common risk appetite throughout the whole company, reported to the board. I have to have all the audits. I have a big six audit firm auditing me. And so we don't have any work to do from a corporate governance standpoint to go public. In the payment industry, you have to do it anyway. And so I look at this as just a way to pay everyone back for all the work they're doing. Okay. So I don't view it as a burden, but rather as a victory for the employees.
No, that makes good sense. And so if you can capitalize on the tailwind that already exists by virtue of the business, why not?
Yeah, and predictability is interesting because in the product business where you're selling widgets, predictability is hard, right? In a payment business where your merchants grow a little bit every month and it's hard for them to switch, just deliver great service at reasonable price and you'll keep your merchants. And so predictability in payments is easier. So it has all the aura of a public company.
Makes good sense. So I'm trying to think 9 years, if there was any soft patches, how did, and obviously COVID may or may not have been near the top of the list, but I'll ask, what any key lessons or takeaways during the pandemic?
So we had one quarter down. We were down 20% when the whole economy shut down. But we've been able to grow every quarter, right? And again, it's about providing good customer service. In this money movement space, it's almost immune from an economic downturn because people need money. They need to take loans out, they need to move money, right? And so we can grow in economic distress, which we did under COVID. And so it's almost countercyclical.
And that makes really good sense. And you're right. There should be an appreciation for the asset class and where you're operating.
Right.
And
And if you look, by the way, during COVID, the processors that serve brick and mortar merchants had huge downturns. Right. Look at Cash App's earnings during that period or Square. They had a big downturn because their brick and mortar merchants closed. We're all online, right? We try to make online equivalent to brick and mortar on money movement. And so we actually flourished during the pandemic. Except for one, actually, I think it was 1 month we were down.
I'm glad to hear that's the case and that it validates the thesis. Looking ahead, how do you start to think about cross-border Canada and Mexico? Is that on the roadmap, or is it exclusively been the union?
So we are in Canada today. What's interesting about regulated businesses is they're very country specific, right? And so it's easy for us to serve US and Canada, and we'll follow our merchants. They'd like to go to Mexico. Mexico looks a lot like kind of an underbanked, underserved US market, right? Just because of the economic differences. And so that looks like a great market for our fintech customers, our regulated customers. And so we will follow them into Mexico, okay, and try to lead them. In Canada, we have merchants on both sides of the border processing, same transactions, same businesses, slight different regulation. So Mexico's next. And then Europe. If our merchants want to go to Europe, Europe is a whole different animal, whole different. So Mexico first.
Okay, no, that makes good sense. And why Europe and not continue down to the rest of Latin America?
This is about merchants, right? And where they want to go. Mexico is easy for them to understand. It's right opposite the border, and they have similar banking laws that the United States has. Okay.
Okay.
Latin America, I think it gets more poor and less banked as you go south, Chile and Brazil excepted. But Europe is a carded market, and it looks a lot more like the United States.
Got it.
That's
And
where they want to go.
while we're on the subject of Europe, would the focus be, and this is totally outside my expertise, but would the focus be on individual countries or the EU?
It would be EU plus Britain. And it is interesting. I think most, speaking as an arrogant American, most financial innovation comes to the United States. You could argue about infrastructure, which may come from over in Europe or India. But if you look at financial innovation, it's come here, right? If you look at what we serve, right, payroll is now every day, okay, which has crushed payday lending in this country. Right. And that's an example, right? Stablecoin is here, right? And matter of fact, stablecoin is all USDC. It's all dollar based, right? And so innovation will start here and then migrate. And the consumers, I think, are similar in both countries. But I'm sure they'd love to get paid every day in Europe, just like they get paid every day here now. And so you'll see fintech innovation move to Europe. And I think we will try to lead that with our customers.
No, that makes good sense. All right, so while we're on the subject of what's in store around the corner, how do you see the payments industry evolving?
So if you look at what's happened, right, when you go into the store today, you swipe your card. Merchant pulls money off that card, and it takes them till the next day to settle, right? They don't get that money the next day. And there's cost on that, right? There's cost because they pull it, there's risk in it, and there's slow settlement. And so we want to turn this merchant pulling money from you, which increase cost and risk, into you push money. So you have to solve the trust issue we talked about earlier. So you can deliver, and where payments are moving is from this pull, cost and risk, to a push, instant risk-free, right? So if you can establish consumer trusting the merchant, the consumer pushing money to the merchant, you've cut cost and risk out. You have the trust factor if you can solve that. So payments are moving from pull to push, from risk to no risk, from cost to no cost. And so that's what we want to do. We want to solve an instant push, low risk, no cost, trusted payments. That's where we're moving this company.
Oh, so yeah, I think you just answered my next question. So that's a tab of pay innovation,
We're
or
trying. We're trying. Yes. But yeah, that would be an innovation. But it
fantastic.
requires all sorts of things. It requires banking. Banks have to be able to make money. You have to be able to establish trust with the merchant. So there's more to solve than technology. You have to have a new business model as well.
Okay, well, but I think that brings up another great point, and one that I also often find myself talking about, especially with the advent of AI, and that's the significance of relationships. What are some of the key, or how do you think about networking? How do you think about your business relationships, and how have you nurtured them over the years?
So I've had my same phone number for since 1993. Was that? That's like 34 years, okay? 33 years. Every customer has my phone number. And I in an enterprise business, B2B that we're in, it's people to people. You have to have value, and AI can communicate the value, right? But in the end, they want to do business with the person. And so I don't think that'll be replaced. Your AI is going to be able to communicate value through a website, chat, or whatever you do, right? But people to people, I think, is critical. And so anyway, I'm a big believer in that. And that's why all of our customers have my phone number and they all call me, which I appreciate.
I think it's so simple and straightforward. Because I was going to ask you if you had a hack, but I think you just gave it to us. I find myself often I'll talk to people just starting out their career in their 20s, in their 30s, and they're not yet at a point to realize that there's tremendous value in having a network of like-minded professionals, but also to give, versus waiting for someone to offer you something. And it sounds like, just given the success you've had a similar experience.
I 100%, right? Again, never solve for yourself, always solve for others, and you will have success. Just a comment you said, I'm a believer in what Jamie Dimon says. You talk about younger people. I think mistakes younger people can make are solving for themselves and saying, I'm going to work remote, right? There's so much value on building personal relationships in the office, and Jamie Dimon is big on this. I'm big on it too, especially with younger workers. I would hate to graduate college, sit at home for 10 years, and not interact with people. flesh to flesh, handshake to handshake. I think that'd be hard.
I would absolutely say until because you haven't become actually exhausted by commuting. Yes, I agree with you 100%.
So I remember I've been an in-office guy for 40 years. My longest commute has been 30 minutes. Okay, and so I've always gone into the office, except during COVID. But yeah, I've enjoyed my career.
That's fantastic. Now, as we talked about beforehand, I am at home. I have been now, oh my gosh, 13 years, and I've had my fair share of commute, which is just a bit soul sucking.
Yeah, I'm sure.
20, 60 minutes. It was a bit much, but I agree with you. We have on our own roadmap to eventually open a physical office here, starting in San Francisco. Next up, as early as Q1 of next year, we will see. But I agree with you. There's no substitute for being face to face.
Yeah, and what's interesting nowadays is the country's actually gotten less mobile. I remember when I was a kid, I used to move around the country with my father. Right, I flew to London to I was in London for a year running a American division, but I had to be in London. Right, nowadays no one moves. Everyone says, "Hey, man, I'm remote because I'm not within 30 miles of your office." Right, but in the old days you'd move. But America is becoming less mobile and more stratified in a community, which I don't know if that's good or bad.
There's definitely pros and cons. I look at my own kids who are now in their 20s, and I just look at home prices and, the neighborhoods where I'd like to see my grandkids get raised, and I don't know how they're going to afford it without our help.
Work at an AI company.
You
Come work
know?
at our company. We want to
There
go public. Yeah.
you go. There's definitely some structural items that need to be addressed. But like all things, I'm optimistic they will get solved. Ronnie, I genuinely enjoyed this. Before we wrap up, because I see we're coming up on the end of the hour. Any key takeaways or lessons that you would, if you had the opportunity, you'd share with your younger self?
A couple. I think I would tell myself to major in the majors and stay away from easy money. Those are two lessons that I've learned over my long career. Okay. And you major in the major. Don't solve small, solve big and solve important. And easy money, usually in my business, it means there's criminal activity or there's something funny, right? If money's easy, something's wrong. So anyway, I would tell my young self those two things.
I think that's fantastic advice. And in fact, I'll get your take on two perspectives. I was talking with one of our interns yesterday, and I said, "Look, it's on you to we'll give you work, but it's on you to make the most of it." And if I had to give you counsel, ask for the most difficult, hardest projects while you're here. And if you fail, well, no one's going to really think twice about it because it was one of the hardest, most difficult projects. But if you succeed, then all of a sudden you start making a name for yourself. So it's win-win, regardless of the outcome.
Actually, that's a really good idea. Don't solve small.
But the other irony of it is, and I don't get credit for this, I don't remember who said it. I heard it in another podcast. But the other benefit of solving really hard problems, if you think of like a normal distribution, there's less competition. But two, it also should arguably attract really smart and effective people because, by definition, smart and effective people like challenges.
Yeah, so how do you do that in an interview? So I totally agree with you. You need people that are curious enough to really dig in and solve big problems. Figure it out in an interview. How do you do that?
That's a good
Right?
question. That could be our next podcast. We'll both give it some thought. We'll compare
Yeah.
notes.
But I appreciate it. I enjoyed the discussion.
Yeah, likewise. Ronnie, before we wrap up, if there's anyone in our audience who'd like to get a hold of you, either because they want to join the team, they want to onboard TabaPay, or potentially start picking your brain about the IPO, how can they find you?
Just call me. Actually, email is probably better. Rodney@tabapay.com.
Done. And you can reference it in the show notes. We'll include it down there as well.
I appreciate it.
Ronnie, I genuinely enjoyed this. I've learned a lot. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Christian. See you.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.